has Ireland, a tiny country where rugby is a minority sport, become one of the top rugby nations in the world? How has an all-Ireland rugby team been maintained despite political partition? These and many more complex questions are explored in a new publication which tells the story of this sport's long history here and its relationship with Irish society. The book is called Blood and Thunder, Rugby and Irish Life, A History. The author is my guest, Liam O'Callaghan, Associate Professor at Liverpool Hope University. Liam, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Hi, Miles. Thanks for having me on.
Now, let's go back. I want to talk about the anthem issue, which is one of the things you raise very, very early on in the book. But how far back can we actually trace organised rugby in Ireland?
Back to the 1860s, basically, I would say. So Trinity College Dublin, the rugby club there, claimed to be the oldest existing club in the world, and they claim 1854 as their foundation date. Now, there was probably a club there at that stage, very likely, and they probably played football, but can we meaningfully call what they played rugby? I wouldn't be so sure about that. The idea that you'd separate football clubs that were very strictly denominated as soccer or rugby was a development for the future. And it was only really in the late 1860s that efforts to have one unified code of football were finally abandoned. So I would say in the 1860s, the club at Trinity became more organised. They were definitely the pioneers, and they developed their own rule book at that time as well. So I would date it to that time, and I would say their claims of 1854 are slightly anachronistic, to be honest.
And then how soon after that does international rugby get up and running, and are Ireland playing matches against, I think, first of all, England and Scotland?
So the first match against England was in 1875, and the second one was against them as well. And from then on, the international series of fixtures that we're now familiar with gradually took shape. Wales were added a little bit later, and France a little bit later than that. And France were periodically kicked out of the competition because they weren't all that faithful to the doctrine of amateurism at times. So from 1875, really. But it wasn't really all that brilliantly organised to begin with. The picking of the team was a slightly chaotic process, and scores of players only got one or two caps. So it was the kind of settled pattern we see these days of players getting many caps and having long careers was a development for the future.
And at that point, was it very much a Protestant sport? Was it very much a unionist sport?
Overwhelmingly so. So my research, I looked at the demographic backgrounds of every player that played for Ireland between 1875 and 1914. And what my research revealed was that of the first 100 men to play rugby for Ireland, covering a period of 8 years, and so up to around 1883, only two of those were Catholic. So the remaining 98 were Protestant. So it was very much a game of the Anglo-Irish elite in Dublin and in Belfast, which was kind of the second base of operations for Irish rugby. It was a game largely confined to Dublin and Belfast in its early years.
Now, so rugby essentially starts before the formation of the Gaelic Athletic Association. Obviously, Gaelic games were going on, or a variety of Gaelic games were going on. What were relationships like in the late 19th century between the two sports?
It depends on what way you approach the question, because a lot of sports people didn't really take much notice of the ideological connotations of sports. And what I mean by that is, obviously, the GEA were very quick to claim the nationalist high ground for themselves and to label practically every other sport as being foreign, in inverted commas. But that, as a set of ideas, took time to develop, and a lot of people were never really in support of that way of looking at things. But the sports were also quite separate, obviously, because it took time for rugby to broaden its appeal beyond the Anglo-Irish elite, as I said, and to attract Catholic players and supporters. And there was this sort of period in the 1890s when the GEA weren't really enforcing the ban, where you actually did have quite a bit of crossover between the two sports. I talk in the book about one particular rugby player called Tom Ahern. He was from West Cork. And over the same weekend, he was selected to play rugby for Ireland against England and selected to play in an All-Ireland Gaelic football final for Cork. So you see kind of quirky little crossovers like that. But after 1901, when the GEA really began to reassert this idea that sports like rugby are foreign and begin to implement the ban in a bit more of a severe way, you get quite a clear division at that point. In terms of relations between the two, the loudest people on both sides were the ones that most people heard. So you'd have GAA polemicists saying that rugby was foreign, but equally bigotry flowed both ways. So there was a degree to which the rugby establishment looked down through their noses at the GAA as well.
Now, when it came then to partition, when it came to the early 1920s, was there a period when it could have gone either way, when rugby could have split north and south? Was that a possibility?
I don't think so. You have to remember again that at the committee table level, let's say, until well into the 1930s, the IRFU was still a Protestant organisation, not in terms of the players on the pitch, but at the committee level, because all ex-presidents became members of the IRFU council and essentially had the whip hand over any decision that had to be made. So it was never likely to happen because the authorities north and south had built fraternal relations. They had similar backgrounds religiously and politically. As well as that, from the perspective of people in 1923, there was no guarantee that partition would last. And equally, rugby decided very quickly, the rugby authorities decided that they would just simply ignore the border. They pretended as if it didn't exist because they really wanted to maintain the unity of the game as far as was possible.
And at what point do the kind of Catholic schools, the Black Rocks of this world, which now dominate the kind of feeder system for rugby, at what point do they begin to assert themselves historically?
The 1880s. So BlackRock took up rugby around 1882. The Leinster Senior Schools Cup, which is the subject of much cultural and journalistic commentary, a level way out of proportion with its importance to the average person. The Leinster Schools Senior Cup was established in 1887 and BlackRock routinely won it from then. They dominated the competition right from the start. A very powerful idea soon took root in these schools, that the quality of the school or the prestige of the school somehow rested on the quality of the rugby team. So not long after BlackRock first entered the Senior Cup, you start to see other Catholic schools entering as well. So Belvedere, Castleknock and so on. And the prestige of the Cup is there right from the beginning. There's a striking archival source at the BlackRock College Archives. It's a community journal that one of the priests kept throughout this period. And the volume of commentary in that little journal devoted to rugby just expands dramatically from the time the Cup is inaugurated onwards. It's just a huge source of pride to the young men involved.
Now, rugby is seen as a middle-class sport, with the exception of Limerick. Is that an historical myth? Or
no.
Was there was a working-class element in Limerick. Why? What happened?
Because they played it on Sundays. So just to expand on that a bit, it's a bit of a long story. But so from the very beginning, rugby in Limerick attracted Catholics and nationalists. And in the mid-1880s, a series of tournaments among little clubs that were formed in the laneways and terraces of the inner city, tournaments began to take place and they were staged on Sundays. And they were all managed by a club called Garry Owen, one of the famous rugby clubs of Limerick. And Garry Owen had at its committee table nationalist politicians, local notables. And rugby took on this kind of role as a beacon of civic pride in Limerick very early in its history. Now, the question you might ask is, why not the GAA? Well, the GAA at this time were in complete disarray in Limerick. Their county board split in 1887. And that kind of organisational chaos isn't really helpful when you're trying to attract people to the game. And by the time they recovered in the 1890s, rugby was too far ingrained in these communities and they simply wouldn't give it up. And they, as I said, they played it on Sundays. There was intense inter-parish rivalries. It was like Gaelic games under different rules. And of course, Sunday rugby wasn't to the liking of the IRFU. They looked down on it. They didn't approve of it at all. But because most of these clubs never affiliated to the IRFU, there wasn't really much they could do about it.
Now, you address the anthem question very early on in the book, and it's obviously a good metaphor for the challenges the IRFU, this cross-border organisation, faced. How does the anthem question pan out over the years?
Well, it was sort of this thing, Miles, that they tried to fudge for a long time. So the convention was, and trying to find written conventions in rugby is difficult. It's like the British Constitution. Everything is unwritten and done by precedent. The sort of convention that was in place after independence was that Auron Naveen would be played at Lansdowne Road as a gesture of respect for the host state. So that was the agreement that was made. It was in no way to be associated with the team. And that sort of arrangement held okay. What they did in Dublin was they wouldn't play the opposition's anthem. And that kind of underscored the idea that the only anthem being played was the one that was a gesture of respect to the state. But where matters came to a head was when the Rugby World Cup came around. And the usual pre-match conventions you associated with international sport, now it was felt needed to be applied to rugby. So Ireland, having not really given any thought to what anthem they would use in the 1987 World Cup, actually played the Rose of Tralee before their opening fixture against Wales, much to the embarrassment of the players. A kind of a saccharine love song like that, it really wouldn't be suitable for players about to play their first World Cup match. So a solution was needed, and that's how we ended up with Ireland's call. Phil Coulter was commissioned to write something that was inoffensive, as rousing as it could be, and I think opinions are mixed as to how much he succeeded with that. I should also add that Ireland never had an anthem for away matches until Ireland's call. So Auron Naveen was never played for Ireland's away matches. And of course, this was a compromise solution because rugby was a game that, since the early 20th century at least, a bit earlier, was a game shared by Northern Protestants and Southern Catholics. These people did not have a shared sense of Irishness, and that's why we all have all these compromises around anthems and flags and so on.
You write that during the height of the Troubles, certain players had to have security teams present.
That's right. So, for example, Jimmy McCoy, the prop from, well, he played for Bangor originally, but because there was an active threat to his life, he had to move to Dungannon. He was an RUC man there. John MacDonald, I think, was an RUC man as well. Brian McCall, these were all in the 1980s. He was a British Army officer stationed in Germany. So we know that simply by dint of their profession, these men were targets. So it took extraordinary bravery on their part to actually come down south for squad sessions and for matches. And they needed a really tight security detail. And it tells us something of their commitment to achieving their sporting ambitions that they actually persevered with that.
Now, you also go into the infamous years when the IRFU clashed with the anti-apartheid movement. I mean, Ireland had a very strong, very influential anti-apartheid movement. There was a great deal of pressure on the IRFU to boycott South Africa. Why did they for so long resolutely refuse to do so?
Because they had this very naive and foolhardy sense that sport, no matter what, could remain aloof from politics. That served them very well in managing North-South relations and the fallout from partition and the Troubles and so on. It served them very well there, but it was a disastrous decision when it came to apartheid, given the international consensus against it. And a colleague of mine has often likened international rugby apparatchiks as basically being the Freemasonry of sport. There are these strange ties of loyalty that cut across everything between these rugby officials of the various countries that play the game. And for some reason, the IRFU allowed that to supersede the express wishes of the government in Dublin. I mean, Charles Haughey, for example, called them in for a meeting in the midst of the hunger strikes in 1981 when he was facing into an election that he was in trouble in. And that gives you a sense of how much he wanted them to cancel their tour to South Africa in 1981. But they still persevered. They still went ahead with it. He told them this could be really costly in terms of our growing economic ties with Africa. Our sports teams could be banned from other competitions, but they just remained unmoved. It was international fraternity above the wishes of the government.
Well, the volume covers many, many more aspects of Irish rugby history than we've been able to touch on this evening. Once again, the book is called Blood and Thunder, Rugby and Irish Life, a History. It's published by Sandy Cove. The author is my guest, Liam O'Callaghan. Liam, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.